What's up, everyone? This is episode 266 of the Wax Museum Podcast, where I talk about all things basketball cards from past to present to future. This is your host, Kyle, and as always, you guys can find me throughout the week on social media. My Instagram is at Wax Museum Podcast. My X account is at Wax Museum PC.
This might be a hot take, but I'm expecting the 3 seed this season.
That is a scorching take, but go on. I don't want to interrupt you here.
If you're watching this in 8 months and that was totally wrong, do not play this back or send it to me. But I think we'll be behind the Bucks. I think we'll be behind the Celtics, but only up from last year.
So that was a clip from a conversation I had back in October with Will, aka Prolific Sports Cards. Well, it turns out his scorching hot take was a little conservative. And this past Sunday, the Knicks clinched the 2 seed in the East in what was a very exciting afternoon of NBA basketball. And almost immediately after, Will messaged me to remind me of that little exchange, which honestly I forgot about. So I am glad that he sent that message to me. We had a good laugh about it. It was all in good fun. But you know what? By that point, I was already on cloud nine because the Pacers won their game against the Hawks, which meant they avoided the play-in tournament. I've talked about that before. I didn't want any part of that. And then the Knicks win that I referenced not too long ago, that also determined that the Pacers will face the Bucks in the first round as the 3-6 pairing. And I'm not saying that's an easy matchup, so do not quote me saying that. I'm not going to sit here and guarantee a Pacers win or anything like that, but I do think it will make for an entertaining first round series. And you know what? I feel pretty good about it. Not that I'm, super excited about the Bucks, but if you're going to have to face the Bucks and Giannis at some point in the playoffs, now is probably an ideal time because, they've seemed kind of off these last couple weeks in general. And then on top of that, they're battling injuries. I know Lillard didn't practice one day this week. And then, of course, Giannis, the big story is he's battling a calf injury. And I've done a lot of research about those this week. I feel like some sort of pseudo expert on that now. At the same time, I don't want to get too excited about this series, though, because anything could happen. Now, if Sunday's excitement and the subsequent play-in tournament wasn't enough basketball content for you, on Monday night, we also had the WNBA draft. Spoiler alert, Caitlin Clark went number one to my Indiana Fever. No surprise there. We all knew that was going to happen. And practically every basketball news outlet and every brand that sponsors Caitlin had some sort of congratulations post or some sort of promo ready to go. From Nike to State Farm to Gainbridge Financial, as they should have, because that's something you can schedule ahead of time and have ready to go. Everyone knew she was going to be the number one pick. Well, guess what? It was nearly 30 minutes before we heard anything from Panini, who just signed her as an exclusive not too long ago. Now, I know they posted a lot of stuff since then, and good stuff too. Footage of all the Panini athletes that they shot leading up to the draft, and Caitlin's still going to get her own sets and everything like that. But not having something ready to go, I'm just not convinced Panini's taking this as seriously as they should. It really does seem like signing her was more so just a move to keep her away from tops. And I know everyone talks about how competition's a good thing for the industry. I agree, and in the past, it has been, and it should still be. But when companies resort to playing defense, instead of just making the right moves on their own, it's ultimately the collectors that lose out. And I really don't like the way that this whole thing has started off with Panini. But you know what? I hope I'm wrong here. And I am no stranger to eating crow, as you heard in the intro of this podcast. So I hope I'm wrong. But I don't feel great about it so far. Anyway, though, back to the draft. There were other picks. I'm not going to recap all of them. I did see a few remarks from people online that were surprised Angel Reese didn't get selected in the next couple picks, despite the fact that, the mock drafts had her projected for later on, like in the 7-9 range. You know what, though? I don't fault these people for questioning that, because these last couple years, we've seen a lot of instances where Caitlin and Angel are talked about as a pair, and then ESPN even had them both on a lot of their graphics for the draft. Well, no matter where Angel was drafted, she's garnered a lot of attention over the last couple years, and rightfully so. She has been awesome. And that's part of why Panini announced an exclusive with her this past week as well. Hopefully, this wasn't another defensive maneuver. Now, they didn't mention any solo sets for her like they did with Caitlin, but they did let us know there will be no shortage of Angel Reese cards. According to the release, quote, Reese will also be featured in Panini's collegiate and WNBA products, including WNBA Origins set to release in August, followed by WNBA Select Basketball and WNBA Prism. Did you catch that little surprise they snuck in there? It wasn't long ago that I speculated Panini would probably add a product or two to their WNBA lineup, and of course capitalize on the sport's popularity. I can't say I was expecting Select. Can't really say I'm excited about it either. I still think a Chronicles-like set would have been the right way to go, but it's good to know we'll be getting new cards. And who knows, maybe they do have something else planned as well. Still no word on how long Panini has that WNBA license, though. I've asked around quite a bit. All I'm getting is speculation, so I can't confirm anything for a fact. But if I hear something, I will definitely let you guys know. Okay, on to the mail. And before I tell you what the first card is, I have to give you some of the story behind it. I've talked a little about this one before. Coincidentally, it was from the episode that I played a clip from earlier, which featured Will, Prolific Sports Cards, and after we finished talking about his Knicks predictions for the year, we chatted some about all the big-name rookies in 1969 Tops, and getting some of those signed. I mentioned that Bill Bradley signs a big batch of his mail every year or so, and it was probably a good time to send, because I hadn't seen anything come back in a long while. Well, after thinking about it a little bit, I decided to take my own advice, and I mailed a Bradley out for myself. So I got everything ready, and I stuck it in my mailbox before work, drove to work, and that day it just poured. Which, you know, I've been doing this for years, that's happened before. The card should still be safe in the mailbox. Well, I pulled up to the house after work, and the flag on the mailbox was still up, but the front door on the box had come open, with my Bill Bradley request still inside, except now it was just a limp, soggy envelope, and the ink from the front of the envelope had bled into some of the other parts, and then there was an envelope inside, that ink had bled as well, and everything was just a mess. My fear was that the card inside was, you know, most likely ruined as well. And this one was worth anywhere from $20 to $30, which, if you're sending something in the mail, and not knowing if you're going to get it back, that's kind of expensive. I generally don't like sending stuff in that price range out to get signed. This situation kind of illustrates why. Anyway, I took the soggy envelope inside the house and began to carefully peel the layers of wet paper away until I got down to the two index cards I had included to help protect the card. Now, I say protect the card, not necessarily against rain, mind you, but you know what? In this scenario, they did kind of seal that card in, so I pried those apart. And much to my surprise, the Bradley card was still in pretty good shape, aside from being soaked and having lost all of its structural integrity. But I figured I would put it between some paper towels, and eventually it might gain some of that back. It just needed to dry out and sit for a little bit. And if it retained enough of its original form, my plan was to just send it again. That sounded a lot better to me than dropping another $30 on a card I still wasn't sure if I would actually get back. So once this thing dried, I waited for the next sunny day outside and put it in the mailbox again. That was back in October. I'd kind of forgotten about it until it showed up again on the informed delivery email that I get every morning. If you guys aren't signed up for that, it's pretty amazing. They literally send you pictures or scans of your mail every morning. And it's not always accurate every single day, but it gives you kind of a time frame when you're going to get stuff back. So for instance, this one showed up a day before it came. I was kind of freaking out, like, hey, it's not in the mail, but it did come the day after. So anyway, 179 days later, this Bill Bradley rookie ended up back in my mailbox, this time dry, and more importantly, signed. Obviously, this is one of those instances where the story behind the card makes it a lot more meaningful than if it had just showed up without any issues. I had to put some legitimate work in for this one, but I finally have it back, and it makes for a nice addition to my signed 69 top stack. And I know I'll never finish that signed set, but I counted them this week, and that puts me at 32 of 99. So I'm about a third of the way there. I still have maybe five or six out. I don't know if they're going to come back or not, but you know what? A third of the way, that's not all that bad. Okay, the second card I received this week, one that never got soaked, to the best of my knowledge, was a 1999-2000 Skybox Dominion Hats Off Relic card of Ron Artest. Now, 1999 Dominion is a product that really doesn't get talked about a lot, save for maybe the Warp Tech parallels, but it had this really cool relic set for about half the guys that were featured in the first round of that year's draft. On the front of each card is a picture of the draft pick wearing a hat and holding a hat, and then the back has a larger picture of the hat, along with a little write-up that explains that it was obtained at the MCI Center during the 1999 NBA draft, and that is, of course, in Washington, D.C. And the pack-pulled versions of these are all hand-numbered on the front. The players, the numbering for the players are all different. It's typically somewhere in the range of 150. In the case of Ron Artest, his is numbered to 140. And I had multiple chances to buy one of these in the $20 range years ago, and I just never did. I remember there was also one on ComC for a long time. But even though I PC Ron Artest, you know, at the time, I just didn't want to spend that on a Bulls card. I try not to get too far outside of his Pacer stuff. You know, it just generally doesn't do too much for me. Although I have branched out a little more in recent years, I don't grab everything, but I will grab stuff from other teams if it's a unique relic or a set that I really like. For example, I've got a 2013 Prism Gold where he's pictured in a Knicks uniform. Well, this feels like a pretty unique relic, and over the years, I think I've taken a lot of the draft stuff for granted. I've been getting into it more in the last couple years, as you guys know. We don't get a lot of that anymore, and definitely not anything with a specific write-up on the back. So, long story short, I decided I wanted one of these. And of course, I couldn't find one for a long time. Finally, this copy showed up on eBay without the numbering, so I'm guessing it was a bankruptcy copy, meaning that it was an extra that was created in case Fleer needed it for replacement or anything like that. And a lot of that stuff was sold off to the general public when Fleer went bankrupt. Hence the title, Bankruptcy Copy. I know a lot of people don't want those. They've got kind of a bad rap in the hobby, and I get it. But it doesn't bother me all that much. The card is still legitimate. It's just not a pack-pulled copy. And in a case like this, I know, you know, for some rare serial-numbered cards, the serial numbering is what makes it, really makes that card what it is. In this case, it's the relic to me that makes it what it is. So not having that numbering isn't really going to kill that card for me. Doesn't mean that, you know, of course I would prefer the regular one, but it's not going to ruin it for me. So anyway, the seller and I went back and forth a little on price, and I think I ended up getting it for $25 or $30, which is funny looking back, because years ago I refused to spend $20 on the numbered version, on the pack pulled version, the more desirable version. And here we are in 2024, I ended up paying more for the lesser desirable one. But that's how this hobby is sometimes. And I'm happy to finally have tracked this one down. All right, before I move into today's main segment, I want to remind you that this show is brought to you in part by the good people over at ComC.com, your home for buying, selling, flipping, and grading. Their consignment marketplace is home to over 33 million cards, from basketball's biggest stars like LeBron James and Kevin Durant to Marvel favorites like Spider-Man and Captain America. ComC has something for every type of collector. Visit ComC.com today to build your collection with your favorite cards. Okay, and then real quick, some of you have asked me for ways you can help support this show. The easiest way is my eBay affiliate link. And using this link costs you absolutely nothing, just an extra 30 seconds or so of your time. But it helps support the show. To access this link, simply go to WaxMuseumPodcast.com, click the eBay logo, shop as planned, so whatever you are going to buy anyway, just click my link first, and the show gets a small commission in the process. Once again, that's www.waxmuseumpodcast.com.
Hey everybody, Boston Steve here, the Northeast correspondent checking in from the city of a winning basketball team, and you are listening to the Wax Museum Podcast.
Okay, so a little over a week ago, my friend and fellow Pacers collector, Vintage Pacers, sent me an eBay link for a cut-up, game-worn jersey of Don Staley. And I know you're probably thinking, a cut-up jersey, that's kind of weird. Yes, it is. But the reason it was cut up is that it used to belong to Fleer. So that really got my attention. And I think Sholey summed it up pretty well as he was roasting me in one of our group chats. He wrote, Kyle won't buy a jersey because he isn't a memorabilia collector, but send that jersey through a shredder and he's all over it. Well, he's not wrong. It's no secret that I love stuff that can give even the slightest look behind the curtain into the world of memorabilia cards. With that being said, Don Staley has been a very popular name in the last few weeks with the NCAA tournament and all, and I figured there'd be a lot of eyes on that listing. So maybe it wasn't the best option for me, provided there were other lots out there. Thankfully, the seller had listed, I don't know, maybe 20, maybe 30 similar lots, so I set out to get one of the lesser-known players for relatively cheap. When I say relatively cheap, I had no idea what something like this would cost, but I figured if there was a player I wanted and it stayed under 50 bucks, I'd be just fine with that. So I followed every listing so I could make that call when the time eventually came, and eventually it did. I think the first one that ended was Sue Bird, and there was barely anything left of that jersey. And unlike some of the other listings, it didn't have a giant Ziploc bag with a Fleer label on it. And I know that might sound goofy, but that was kind of important to me. If I was going to buy something like this, part of the appeal is that it helps me narrate hobby history. So anything that indicates this stuff is from Fleer, even if it's just a label, that's a plus. Ultimately, I decided there wasn't much left of this jersey, and it would just be best to let the first one in low, so that's what I did. I passed on a few others before eventually deciding that I wanted to make a serious run at Yolanda Griffith. She was a recognizable name, she's in the Hall of Fame, and I actually needed a patch of her for my Hall of Fame PC. Winning this lot would, of course, give me plenty, although not on actual cards, but it would give me a lot of patch pieces. And Yolanda's jersey pieces ended up costing me in the $25 range, so I was very happy with that, and I was finally on the board. From there, I won a couple of former Los Angeles Sparks players, Muadi Mabika and Tamika Dixon, and admittedly, I didn't know anything about them before I went after these jerseys. I've since read some about them online. I know Muadi was able to come here to the States and play partially because of Dikembe Mutombo. He played a pretty big role in that. And then I also learned more about Tamika's journey and her career prior to professional ball at Kansas. So anyway, I've read some about them since acquiring these pieces, and I grabbed these lots because they were super cheap. I think I got the Mabika pieces for like 99 cents. There wasn't much left of that jersey, but it still had a Reebok logo tag and the 9/11 Unity ribbon patch intact. So that's definitely worth a buck to me. The final lot I picked up was from Nakisha Sales of the Orlando Miracle, a team that later became the Connecticut Sun. It was listed as a 2001 All-Star Game jersey. After sorting through all the pieces, I think it was part of her 01 jersey, but also something else, because even though there was a loose 2001 All-Star patch in the bag, the main part of the jersey also had a Reebok logo and that 9/11 Unity ribbon. Neither one of those were on jerseys until 2002, and I'll touch more on some of the other confusing stuff in a moment here, but anyway, this package of jerseys finally comes in the mail, and I showed it to Mrs. Wax Museum, and she was not impressed, and it's not the first time that's happened this month, and it won't be the last, and that's okay, that's just, we're fine, we've passed that point to where it's a big deal. But I wanted to see what all I had. So I took the bags of pieces and carefully sorted through them on the kitchen table, one at a time. I mentioned earlier that the bags had Fleer labels on them. Well, according to the seller, he or she purchased all of these lots from Rittenhouse, who is the company that had the NBA license for a while starting in 2005. And the description claimed when Fleer lost the rights to the WNBA, they had to return everything left over to the WNBA. Everything they gave back, including the leftover material pieces, were passed on to the next licensor to use. These, along with a number of other jersey relic patches, were never used, and I picked them up as part of a large collection. I don't think the seller's making up stories here, but I also don't 100% believe that's exactly what happened. And I talked to a big WNBA relic collector earlier this week, and they expressed similar doubts. I think it's more likely that Rittenhouse purchased all these lots from either Fleer or the Fleer bankruptcy auction instead. In fact, I know some other small manufacturers did that as well for like the NBA jerseys and some of the other sports, but I have no way to prove it about all these specific pieces. So like I said, I'm not calling that seller a liar. I've just never heard of a scenario like that before. And I've read quite a bit about the whole FLIR bankruptcy situation. I mean, I remember some of it too, just from being active in the hobby at that time. Either way though, after sorting through these pieces, the evidence shows it's pretty certain they belonged to FLIR at one point. Now, I mentioned earlier that I wanted these to sort of peek behind the curtain on memorabilia cards. There was some really cool stuff in there. Some of the pieces had the white backing adhered to it in anticipation of chopping them up for cards. I've talked a little about this before when discussing Panini's process for making memorabilia cards. There's a really good Pete Maravich jersey video on YouTube that shows their process as well. But each Panini jersey gets a unique 6-digit number. And that number is stamped all over the white backing they adhere to these larger jersey pieces. Well, there were no such numbers on these WNBA pieces. And I've seen pictures of some of FLIR's chopped up NBA jerseys before too. And they didn't have it either. So that doesn't appear to have been part of their process. In addition to the larger pieces with white backing, a couple of the jerseys had bags with large portions that had already been chopped up and were left over. The Yolanda Griffith lot appeared to be what was left of her 2003 All-Star Game jersey, which had been partially used up in a 2004 FLIR Ultra set called All-Star Material Patches. It says so on the back of the card. And the prime version of that set was numbered to 100. There were a lot of really nice pieces left over that didn't make the cut, including pieces of a laundry tag and even a couple really small pieces from the edge of the Logo Man, or Logo Woman, I guess I should say in this case, which confirmed something about FLIR for me that I already knew, but it was nice to see more evidence, and that is that FLIR chopped up quite a few Logo Man patches in the early 2000s. And I know a lot of people see partial Logo Man patches in FLIR cards that might be numbered to 50 or 99, and they automatically assume they're fake. And I think some level of skepticism is warranted because there were some, you know, shenanigans that people pulled back in the day and still do, but there were some shenanigans. But in this case, a lot of them were also real with FLIR. And I didn't personally pull any, but I know people that did. It was a thing. And as I'm going through these bits and pieces of WNBA jerseys, well, what did I come across? A couple of very small Logo Man pieces. They weren't big parts of the logo, but it was enough to tell that's what it was. And they were mixed in with the general prime pieces, as well as, like I said, laundry tags, number pieces, and so on. There were some bags that had pieces with different types of material. When I say that, I mean like, you know, the jersey styles look different, almost as if they were different brands. I couldn't tell if it was just that, you know, maybe one was shorts, one was a shooting shirt, but it seemed like all of the leftover pieces of a certain player were just lumped together. And I'm not sure if that's a FLIR thing as much as it is a bankruptcy auction liquidation thing, so I don't want to draw any major conclusions from that. Anyway, it took me about 20 minutes to do my first quick run through of all these pieces. I won't give you every single detail here, but that footage will be up on my YouTube by the time this airs. I know the first part will be Tuesday, the second part will be up on Thursday. And now that I've gone through this stuff and taken some notes, I'm left figuring out what comes next. To be perfectly honest, if it's like a lot of my stuff, it will go in a box, where I can take it out a couple times a year maybe, and enjoy it from time to time. And there's a part of me that wants to find a good use for some of it too. I don't really want to chop anything up that's still intact. But there is a nice piece of the neck area on that Yolanda Griffith jersey that says Monarchs on it. I think that would make a really nice custom relic card once I get a little more practice. I know I keep saying that. I need to actually sit down and try and figure this stuff out. My wife's got two Cricut machines that are collecting dust. Don't tell her I told you that. But yeah, I need to figure this out and say, you know, maybe I can use these to make custom cards. And then similarly to that Yolanda Griffith, you know, Monarchs piece, there's a really nice Nikesha Sales 9/11 ribbon that I think would be good for a custom as well. It's already been separated from the rest of the jersey, so it's not like I'm cutting that off or anything like that. So you know what? I say once I get more practice, I've talked about using the Cricut machine. Maybe I just need to message Reclaim Customs again so I make sure it's done right. You might remember he did an amazing job with my Iverson Logo Man. All right, well, there you have it. That's all I've got regarding these jerseys for now. Hopefully you got a kick out of hearing about those. Maybe there was something I talked about today that resonated with you. Feel free to reach out to me on social media. You can find me on Instagram under @WaxMuseumPodcast or X under the handle @WaxMuseumPC. In the meantime, if you like the content I'm providing, please subscribe, rate and review on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Podcast. Hit up the website for my affiliate links. Tag Taco Bell and let them know they can pay me in burritos. And until next time, this is the Wax Museum Podcast.